Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, who are the people who can be kind, even in the face of genocide? Acclaimed psychology professor Irvin Stubb joins us to discuss the roots of goodness. But first, a look inside the arms trade and its effects on politics and society. We're joined by Dean and Professor Suzette Grelot. She's the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and she has authored several books on the subject, including The International Arms Trade, Arms Control in the Environment, and Arms on the Market, Reducing the Role of Proliferation in the Former Soviet Union. Welcome, Suzette Grelot.
Thank you so much, Maria. It's great to be here.
Fascinating research. Why don't we start with how did you decide to research the subject of the arms trade in the first place?
Well, it's a little bit of a story, but let me start that my academic work as a graduate student really began on weapons of mass destruction. I focused on trying to control arms control, basically, weapons of mass destruction. I spent a lot of time in Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. I wrote a dissertation on Ukraine's decision to give up its nuclear weapons. So this was back in the early to mid to late 90s. And so I was doing a lot of work on export controls and dual-use technology. And, that's really how my interest, I guess, in arms got started out of my interest in human rights. I was kind of interested in human rights, and particularly in that part of the world. And so I started looking at weapons issues as the Soviet Union was coming apart. So it really wasn't the arms trade per se, and certainly the conventional arms trade, which is where I spent most of my later academic life, until I graduated with my PhD. I came to the University of Oklahoma and was asked to write a chapter for a book on the environmental impact of disarmament. And so that's one of the co-edited books that you mentioned there was Arms in the Environment. And I was asked to write the chapter on conventional weapons, which I knew nothing about. And so, but of course, being an assistant professor, I said, well, sure, I need a publication. So I went and started a whole new project on conventional arms. And this was in the late 90s. And I was just fascinated then by the conventional arms issue, again, particularly from a human security perspective. And then, of course, the global flow, basically, of small arms and light weapons in particular, but conventional weapons in general. So I really made the shift from weapons of mass destruction to what we call weapons of individual destruction, weapons that have actually killed more people overwhelmingly than any weapon of mass destruction has. And so that's kind of how I got into it, was just being asked to write this book chapter and taking that leap. And then it kind of was just caught up by the importance of that issue at the time and kept pursuing it from there on.
Well, since you mentioned the environmental impact, that is something that I've often wondered about. So the environmental impact, of course, of war is awful, but of disarmament?
Yeah, so the project involved disarmament from all perspectives. So nuclear disarmament, chemical, biological disarmament, tearing apart missiles. I mean, obviously, we are heavily militarized around the world, certainly in certain parts of the world. And there are significant environmental consequences, not only of war, as you mentioned, and the destruction that causes to our environment. But when you get rid of these weapons, right, so you want to disarm and dismantle your nuclear arsenal, or at least scale back, which we've done, of course, then what do you do with all this fissile material? Where does it go? And how do we protect the environment from this radioactive material that lasts for thousands and thousands and thousands of years? And the same for chemicals. I mean, what do you do with chemicals when you take a chemical weapon and dismantle it? You know, how do you protect the environment from those chemicals? It's not like you can just bury it or pour it down the drain, or, it's not that simple. You have to really think carefully about how you dismantle these weapons. And so in the case of conventional weaponry, there's perhaps less of an environmental impact, except for the fact that you do have, a lot of scrap left around and a lot of, for example, take landmines, for example, and the environmental impact of landmines when it comes to after war, there's a lot of landmines left behind that then prevent us from being able to use territory and access that, whether it's farmland or homeland or whatever it is. But that's in a real environmental impact, not so much of disarmament per se, but of the after effects of war, and then trying to disarm those things so that you can have access to your environment. So those are the kinds of things that we were discussing in that book.
A student of mine, a former student, had sent me an article just yesterday about Fallujah and the super high cancer rates and how truly horrific it is on the public health, the aftermath of the war. So apparently they haven't even cleaned it up very well, at least to protect the generations that are continuing to live there. How do you conduct research on something like the arms trade when there is so much that is not really in the public documents. So much of it is sort of a little bit on the radar, a little bit below the radar.
This is an excellent question and something, obviously, as a researcher, we deal with often. I mean, there are people that don't really study the arms trade because it is really tricky in terms of the data. There's official arms trade data, official government-to-government transfers and sales. So that stuff is, you know, for the most part, above the radar, I guess. Is that what you would call it? Yeah, above board and within the radar. I mean, you can definitely see it. Countries like the United States, for example, put out annual reports about their weapons sales, maybe not to the great detail that one might want, but certainly you can find values and recipients and that sort of thing. But on the illicit side, which is really where I've spent a significant amount of my time, it's much more challenging. And, you know, that stuff is not transparent. It's not like there are gun runners and others out there keeping the books. Well, I mean, they may be keeping books, but they're
ready to tell you all about
it. Right. They may be keeping books, but they may not, you know, be sharing it. But interestingly, you go out and you meet some of these people, which is exactly how I've had to do my research. You have to go out and find and meet these people. And they do want to tell you about it, strangely. They do want to tell you about it. And so they'll kind of lay out for you, maybe not specifics, but in generality, kind of what they have, where it goes, what they're shipping and how they're shipping it, how they're getting access to these things, and then what they're using it for. So it's pretty interesting how you have to go about doing this kind of research. Now, there are organizations like the Small Arms Survey, for example, that do a lot of research, on a topic that isn't very transparent, by doing a lot of calculations and gun multipliers, if you will. They'll do as much research as they can of what they can kind of find that is above board, and then they develop these major models of how they then calculate what the closer number is, right? Because I mean, what you're seeing is really what you're able to see, what you observe. So when I've been out in the Balkans, for example, and I go and I observe, you know, weapons out in the hands of rebels, that's only, you know, a certain percentage of what they really have available to them. So then they come up with these force multipliers, if you will, that will allow them to better estimate what kind of guns are out there and where they're going. My interest, even though I've done some bean counting, I guess if you want to call it that, gun counting, has been more in like trafficking flows, patterns, where things are moving to and from, you know, and then kind of the motivation of people. Obviously, you know, gun runners are mainly motivated by money, just like anybody else who's smuggling something, whether it's, you know, whether it's guns, drugs, or people for that matter. They're profit motive. They're motivated by profit, and they'll tell you that, and that they're capitalists and that they're making a buck just like anybody else. And as long as it's profitable for them to traffic in this kind of commodity, they will do so. It's really difficult and tricky to study because of all of this, and, you know, sometimes sketchy and concerning. But for the most part, you just have to kind of just dig and triangulate however you can, and talk to people who are working in the field, journalists, NGO, and international organization members, and kind of try to put two and two together and see what you got.
I'm reminded of you, it's been a while since you published this book, so you may not even remember this particular vignette, but at the beginning of your book, you had a vignette about some healthcare workers that were released from a Libyan prison. And the argument was, no, there was no exchange money for prisoners or anything like that. But shortly thereafter, there was a gun deal with Libya. How does this fit into the whole scheme overall?
Sure. Well, that was one particular example. I think there are many examples you can find of where there's kind of a tit for tat, you know, you do this and I'll, you know, transfer you some weapons. And you know, governments aren't innocent there. I mean, we've all heard of things like Iran-Contra and other types of gun dealing deals, I guess, you know, or gun transferring deals. So again, these aren't on the front pages. These aren't things that are easily, you know, regularly advertised and promoted, but they certainly do happen regarding, you know, let's do this prisoner exchange or something. And in exchange, you know, you'll be paid off, not with cash, or not with, you know, commodities of any other sort other than weaponry.
Right. So then if you could give us a sense of the scope of what are we talking about in terms of how big is the weapons trade, and especially if there have been any trends, has it been changing?
So, as you mentioned, Maria, it's been a while since I've published the book. So today's data, I'm not as familiar with it, but here's, I think, the general trend. So since the Second World War, when really, well, let's go back even further. Since the First World War, when private companies were really engaged in the arms trade without much government regulation, that was kind of reined in. And so governments are very much involved in monitoring and licensing gun deals. Obviously, private companies are involved. They make these guns and they make the artillery and whatever it is that's being sold and traded. So we're talking about tens of billions of dollars every year in guns, in weapons deals around the world, tens of billions. The United States has been for a long time the world's leader in the weapons market. Russia was always its main competitor, but countries like France and the UK, the Belgians, the Germans, have also competed significantly in this area, but nobody even comes close anymore. More really to sniffing the value of the weapons that are sold from the United States, but that's all on the kind of again the above board side. The illicit trade, again, it's very difficult to calculate, but it's probably around $5 billion or so per year, approximately. Again, this is a major approximation because it's hard to know for sure, but it's a certain percentage of that in terms of the value per year that of these types of weapons. In terms of numbers, and again, I rely on small arms survey numbers. Having spent most of my time focusing on small arms and light weapons, in terms of the numbers of guns, there are about 1 million or so, maybe a little bit more, that they estimate that are in circulation every year, overwhelmingly in the hands of individuals, civilians, not police and military forces. So that's an interesting factoid, I think, is that, we kind of think of military and police forces, law enforcement, as being kind of the primary keepers of weapons. Obviously, in the United States, that's not necessarily the case. We're obviously a gun-owning country. You can own guns here. But there are a lot of countries where you can't own guns legally. There are a lot of countries where, guns are not likely to be found. They just don't have the kind of gun culture. But around the world, we do have about 1 million or so small arms and light weapons that are in circulation. And that includes everything from, pistols to, shoulder launched, rockets. I mean, it's anything that's small and light and easy to carry and trade and conceal and smuggle. That's kind of the estimation for that. And so when you say that a big chunk of that are held by civilians or by individuals, then sometimes people kind of go, whoa, this might be troubling in the sense that, if you have kind of a militarized society, particularly owning and potentially using military style weaponry, the civilian population owns and operates a lot of military style weaponry, then that's where some suggest that's problematic. Maybe not so much the ownership itself, but the kind of rules and regulations that they're subject to, right? So so maybe that moves us to a discussion of the law on this issue, in terms of how many guns you can own, what kind of guns you can own, who you can sell them to, these kind of we call secondary sales, where people buy weapons and then sell them, to other individuals, of course, or traffic them. So, there's a lot going on within this issue, and sometimes it's hard to pick out, again, that kind of the legal stuff that's acceptable and kind of following rules and regulations and is monitored, and you're legally, licensed to own this weapon versus those that are procuring them in an illicit way or an illegal way, and doing who knows what with them. So the problem is that it is so complicated by all of these different issues, not to mention the different laws and different regulations that different countries have, but that it's hard to kind of categorize all of these weapons into these are legit and these aren't, and how does this work, and how do you prevent the legitimate arms from becoming illegitimate arms, because overwhelmingly weapons begin as legally sold weapons, legally procured weapons that then find their way somehow, some shape or form, either through theft or, improper sales or procurement into the illicit market. So this is why I think I'm raising these issues, because this is why I think many choose not to really study this from an academic perspective because it is really messy. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I thought was really important that I read in your work was about how this trade affects all aspects of our lives that we don't even see, you know, democracy itself, so governance, culture, security. And so I thought it would make sense to understand how it affects these aspects of our lives that we don't see.
So the consequences are significant. And again, I think as you're suggesting, I'll just reiterate, they're kind of invisible. I mean, in the sense that you can't easily draw a connection between some of those consequences and, you know, an armed society. But you talked a little bit ago about the student that sent you the article about public health. I mean, there are significant public health consequences to, you know, an overly armed society, not just here. And again, I don't study the U.S. I don't study guns in the U.S. It's not, there are like no benefits of studying guns in the U.S. I study weapons trade and weapons flows in other parts of the world, and particularly post-conflict societies. So let's just focus on the consequences of weapons in post-conflict societies, because that's really what I know best. And that is, there are significant health consequences, obviously, in societies that are post-conflict that already struggle with dealing with their health concerns and crises in general. And then you add an enormous amount of gunshot, you know, wounds and gunshot activities that really put a lot of pressure on their public health system. So significant consequence there. Obviously, having a significantly armed society, particularly civilian population in a post-conflict society, really does hinder, you know, peace and conflict resolution processes and the ability to, you know, to resolve the conflict that began in the first place. So that's why disarmament of this sort is usually written into post-conflict agreements, whether it's in the Balkans, as I'm most familiar with, or whether it's in Ireland between, you know, the Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland, is that there was there's always some sort of disarmament plan involved, because weapons in the hands of those communities in a post-conflict environment will hinder process toward peaceful discussion and negotiation, and there will kind of always be this temptation to run back to your guns. And I've seen that so many times in my time in the former Yugoslavia and in the Balkans. So you have public health, you have, you know, peace and conflict issues. You know, we've touched on environmental issues just because of the use of these types of weapons that then prevent you from having, you know, true access to your land and the ability to cultivate it. You have educational consequences. So multiple social consequences and health consequences, but also, you know, political and economic consequences, and in the sense that, you know, development really requires investment in, you know, things that will create jobs and an ability to, you know, set up a new business and all of those kinds of incentives. Well, if your government funds are being drained by, you know, trying to clean up post-conflict armed messes, trying to deal with the public health consequences, trying to deal with the, you know, other educational and social consequences, then it's that the money's going to that and then can't, you know, properly be funneled into, you know, better governance or, you know, the creation of economic opportunity and things like that. So there are multiple consequences, political, economic, social, and otherwise, that particularly in post-conflict societies where, again, we may not draw that line directly. Okay, there are lots of guns and these things happen, but certainly there are lots of guns. There's war and conflict. There's a lack of trust, and therefore all of these other consequences that drain the society of its ability to recover from that.
Do you think that there's also, on the economic side, the incentive to keep conflicts going?
Well, sure. I mean, okay, so there's a huge literature written on kind of the economy of war, right? And obviously major wars where you have weapons producers and others that are benefiting from that type of activity. I mean, I would say on the small arms and light weapons side, when we're talking about post-conflict societies in certain parts of the world, that's a harder argument to make. You know, I mean, there are those certainly that are going to benefit economically from illicit activities. As I was mentioning earlier, the gun runners and other smugglers that are benefiting from a lack of rules, a lack of good governance, and you know, and are moving down that path largely because of a lack of economic opportunity. That's where they're getting their payoffs. Government officials that perhaps are getting their payoffs and, you know, from illicit activity and black market activity. I mean, certainly there's a huge connection here between what we're talking about with weapons and arms and organized crime. That's the other thing. And again, the kind of the organized criminal network that this perpetuates and kind of facilitates violence and violent activity, you know, among organized criminals. So I think it's hard to make a strong argument that there's an economic motivation to perpetuate conflict in these kinds of conflicts that I'm talking about, in places like in various countries in Africa and the former Yugoslavia, perhaps some places in Latin America. Certainly, there's been this argument made in the past, particularly among developed countries, that war economies are sometimes good for you. But seriously, that's a major trade-off, right? It's a major trade-off in blood and treasure, you know, to engage in war and conflict, you know, for that economic payoff.
So what are some of the ways that the international community has tried to keep the gun trade under some kind of control? What are the resolutions and agreements and that type of a thing, and have they had some success?
So again, an excellent question, Maria. And and arms control is this is obviously, you know, almost my whole academic career has been spent on arms control of some in some way, shape, or form. Small arms and light weapons, or conventional arms control, is of course extremely difficult. Nuclear weapons control, chemical and biological weapons control, I mean, we have pretty solid international agreements. And there's a pretty solid taboo about weapons of mass destruction for the most part. I mean, there are a few violators here and there, but overwhelmingly, people around the world, countries around the world, buy into the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Biological Weapons Convention. We have just a few defectors. On the conventional weapons side, look, I mean, the problem is that conventional weapons do have legitimate uses, right? Military and police forces need to have, they have to be armed. I mean, that's just that. So there are those who argue that there are legitimate uses for conventional weapons of all sizes, big and small. So that being the case, you can't talk about a ban. You can't talk about any kind of international agreement or anything that will ban these types of weapons. We have a few examples of things that have been banned, anti-personnel landmines that have been banned. And there's a pretty strong international norm now about the production and use and sale of anti-personnel landmines. Cluster munitions is another conventional weapon that has been, there's a global convention on cluster munitions, cluster bombs that do a lot of damage, particularly to civilian populations. So, you know, there are a few examples of where you ban those weapons, but it's not like conventional weapons as a category are going to be banned, and it's certainly not like you're going to ban, you know, firearms and small arms and light weapons. So that being the case, you have to pick off little bits of things at a time. So the international community has focused largely on illicit trafficking, on the illicit production and trade of weapons, small arms and light weapons, military style in particular, small arms and light weapons. So there is an arms trade treaty that was signed overwhelmingly in the international community that outlines principles about controlling, or at least, you know, managing, I mean, because again, you're not going to stop the trade, but you're going to minimize the trade. I mean, everybody's kind of just in agreement that we need to do that. But again, it's on the illicit side, right? Trying to eliminate illicit production. So again, just your everyday citizen who wants to go in and can legally procure a weapon, that's still, you know, totally open for debate and not really part of any global discussion or treaty, and purposefully so. Organizations like the National Rifle Association, for example, which of course is an American interest group that focuses on guns in the United States primarily, but in order to protect what they consider to be one's kind of global right to own arms, created a global organization and has led a global campaign to keep civilian ownership or maintain civilian ownership and the legality of civilian ownership in international documents like the global the Arms Trade Treaty. So the NRA has gone global and has set up its counterparts around the world and have actually worked hard to defeat referenda, for example, in Brazil, which has had a significant problem in the past with ownership of weapons and the use of weapons among criminals, many criminals in Brazil. The NRA and its counterpart in Brazil worked very hard in a very short period of time, actually, to defeat the referendum there, where the people were slated a few years ago to vote for or against being able to own guns. And so it's a more and more of a global issue that is being brought out by NGOs or interest groups like the NRA, but also the United States government in some ways. Some have failed to or refused to fund, for example, disarmament methods in Sierra Leone. The United States actually refused to provide $200,000 from the United States government that had been committed to help the Sierra Leoneans disarm after their major conflict, their civil war, suggesting that Sierra Leoneans have a constitutional right to own a weapon just like Americans do. So there, reiterating the very complicated nature of this issue is you have very people that are really wanting to control weapons and particularly illicitly produced and traded weapons, and then there are those who don't, and they're battling it out in terms of how are we going to manage this issue, trying to find some common ground so that we can get at the right things, and really just kind of the lowest common denominator being illicitly trafficked weapons seems to be where they found that common ground.
I had read a little bit about this long before you and I started talking, and I had understood from what I had read that even the above board transactions generally have some things that are illicit within them. And there was a black market, but also a gray market. What is that?
Yeah. Important point is that what defines the gray market being its unintended consequences. It's the unintended nature. Okay, so about gray market sales specifically, you've got the regular market and you've got the black market. The gray market is somewhere in between in the sense that you have producers of whatever it is, but in this case, weaponry, that are then exchanged in a way that the producer means for it to be legitimate, but yet somewhere along the way, it ends up kind of there's some unintended consequences and some unintended usage of those materials. So there may be complicit, the producers and sellers may be somewhat complicit or maybe turning a blind eye or whatever, but in the sense that it kind of becomes a halfway mark, right? It's gray. We don't really fully understand exactly how it happens, but that's somehow that transaction, which perhaps was meant to be legal and above board, ends up being less so in terms of the recipient and how it's used. The technical definition being unintended, but who knows? I mean, those who engage in the gray market aren't necessarily going to admit that they're engaged in gray market sales. Illicit transfers or illegal transfers, but perhaps are sales made, again, government to government or government to non-state actors that aren't fully reported and that aren't necessarily fully transparent in how they're produced. In other words, there are some potentially questionable operations. The legit market is the biggest. I mean, by far, the above board sales are huge. The black market, of course, is also pretty substantial. The gray market, it's hard to really tell exactly what fits in which category, but it is fully gray, I guess. And that's maybe why we don't know so much about it. It's just a shady area that isn't quite fully above board. But, some might say, well, they need those weapons for this purpose or whatever. And it's just kind of, you'll look past it.
You had mentioned the manufacturers of the greatest number of these arms, and you didn't mention China. And I thought I remembered also China being one of the leaders in sort of this more black and gray market. Is that the case?
Definitely. China is a major player. It's becoming more and more of a major player. Still not as large as, the United States, which of course, takes the gold medal every time. Russia and our European players, because particularly for the United States and the Europeans, there are a lot of private enterprises, right, that produce these weapons and sell these weapons. So it's a big part of our economy. The Russians, it's more government production, some private production, but not really. And then of course in China, China. It's not really private production. It's state-produced weaponry. But nonetheless, they are participating more and more as weapons exporters. They are also a major importing country. So unlike the United States, Russia, and those in Europe, China does both. It exports and imports at high levels. But Chinese-made weapons have still not quite reached that quality level, I guess, that you have in your original, you know, Russian Kalashnikov. Although the Chinese have their version, and there are lots of, you know, knockoffs, if you will, of the Kalashnikov. But the Chinese are more and more important players. And in fact, I spent 4 months in China trying to learn as much as I could about the arms trade. And I learned absolutely nothing about the arms trade because no one will even talk about the arms trade in China, not even just to give their perspective or just to put a smiley, happy face spin on it. Nothing at all. They refused. And if I spent 4 months in Europe or Russia or anywhere else in the world, I could gather a lot of information about their arms trade practices. And in China, it was absolutely impossible. I had to focus most of my attention on port security there, which they were happy to talk about. But the arms trade and their arms production and arms sales, absolutely no response whatsoever. So they're also very quiet about what it is that they're doing.
The last question where we should leave this is, where should the international community go with this trade?
I'll tell you what, the biggest players on this issue are non-governmental organizations. They're the ones that moved governments on the landmine issue. Those are the ones that moved on the cluster munitions issue. Those agreements would have never happened among governments if it hadn't been for NGOs. There are a number of NGOs, faith-based and otherwise, you know, that are really concerned about the global arms trade and are working very hard to try to keep it on the agenda for states. Because obviously, you know, state actors have to be involved. I mean, they're the, I say air quote here, legitimate owners of weaponry, really, in the sense that they license whether things can be sold or not. And so at least the big time sales. So NGOs are really, really active on this issue around the world from a human security perspective in particular. So they have to keep at it, and they have to keep the international community engaged on this issue. As far as like what kind of new agreements, I mean, the agreements we have, the UN protocols and the arms trade treaty, I mean, we really need to work on implementing these things and providing some more ability to some teeth in them, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, so to be able to implement them and hold people accountable for complying with these things. So that's the big challenge. New agreements, I don't think, are going to be coming. And if they are, they're going to be specific to certain weapon systems, but they need to work on making sure that these agreements are implemented and people are abiding by the rules.
Suzette Grelot, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for your time. Suzette Grelot is the Dean and Vice Provost of International Programs at the University of Oklahoma. She has co-authored 6 books, including The International Arms Trade, Arms Control and the Environment, and Arms on the Market, Reducing the Role of Proliferation in the Former Soviet Union. When we come back, who are the people who can be kind even in the face of genocide? Acclaimed psychology professor Irvin Stubb joins us to discuss the roots of goodness. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest has long studied the roots of violence, genocide, and other destructive acts. His work then turned to the roots of what he called goodness, when people rescue one another, even at the risk of their own lives. And with that, he has turned to how we can establish societies that are built on altruism and moral courage. Irvin Stubb joins us now. His latest book is called The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Irvin Stubb. It's great to have you back with us.
It's very nice to speak to you again.
Well, before we get into this latest book that you have just published, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, you wrote in the introduction about how your own experiences as a Holocaust survivor shaped your work. Can you first tell us what happened to you and how this has impacted your work?
Well, when I was 6 years old, it was the worst of times in Hungary, certainly for Hungarian Jews. The Hungarian government enacted anti-Semitic laws for quite a long time. It started even before Hitler appeared on the scene in Germany. So over the years, there was quite a bit of anti-Semitism, and Hungary was a voluntary ally of Germany, rather than many other countries which were occupied. And 1944, early, when the Germans found out that the Hungarian ruler was trying to establish a separate peace with the Allies, because he realized that the war was being lost, they occupied Hungary in March 1944. And then 50 SS officers, led by Eichmann, the infamous Eichmann, came to Hungary, and with the help of something like 200,000 Hungarian policemen and gendarmes and people from the population, they gathered all the Jews from the countryside, put them on trains, these incredibly crowded, terrible trains, and took them to Auschwitz. And most of them were killed right away. The Jews in Budapest were left. They were the last ones. But the war was coming to an end. Nonetheless, the Germans and the Hungarian helpers were trying to get rid of all the Jews. So we were first in a house that was designated as a house with Jews in it, and it had to have a yellow star on it. And then we had to wear yellow stars. And then there was a ghetto established, and a lot of Jews had to be moved in there. Now, in the summer, after all Hungarian Jews were killed, there was a refugee board established around that time in the United States. It should have been established much earlier, but it wasn't established, and then finally it was, and one of its first acts was to ask a Swede to go to Hungary and try to save Hungarian Jews. And it was a Swede, because Sweden was a neutral country. And so a Swedish diplomat was asked first, Count Bernadette, but the Hungarians would not accept him. And Raoul Wallenberg, who was not a diplomat, was asked to go because he was a partner in a export-import business with a Hungarian Jew. He lived in Sweden. And so he agreed to go to Hungary, and he acted with great determination, very cleverly, and very heroically in many ways to save lives. And he succeeded to persuade the Hungarian government to allow him to create 4,000 these protective passes that said that the people who hold these passes after the war will go to Sweden, and so they are now under the protection of Sweden. And in addition to these 4,000 passes, he created many more. And so my mother, my aunt, three cousins, my sister and I were able to get these protective passes and left our apartment, pushed a little cart during the night with a few belongings to go to the so-called protected house that Wallenberg set up, not just one, but a number of them. And my father, who was in a forced labor camp, when his group was being taken to Germany, they had a stayover in Budapest in some old military barracks, and he escaped. And for various reasons, he knew where we were. And he came to that house, and the superintendent allowed him in. And he was in hiding in that house. He survived several raids on the house by Hungarian Nazis who were helping the Germans. And so all of us survived in that house. Now, in terms of what influenced my work, another important person was a woman who worked for my family. And rather than leaving us, She came with us to this protected house. This was a Christian woman. And she did all kinds of amazing things to try to help us. One of them was to make dough and take it to a bakery and have it baked into bread and then bring it back. And she did this a number of times. Once she was stopped, she was told that because she is helping Jews, she's a traitor, and they made her stand with her hands up and standing against the wall, and she thought that she will be killed. And then finally, somebody from the neighborhood who was also a Nazi and who knew her came by and said, oh, she's all right, let her go. And she immediately continued to do what she did. And actually, it's possible that my father had the courage to escape because she took to the forced labor camp a copy of this so-called protective pass and had someone call him to the fence and handed him a copy of this. We don't know this for sure, but this may have given him courage. So anyway, we survived in this so-called protected house, and I think that that inspired really everything that I did. You know, I escaped from Hungary in 1956 and lived in Vienna and came to the United States and studied and got a PhD at Stanford in psychology. And then at my first job at Harvard, I started to study what leads people to help others and what leads people not to help when they see other people's need. And then later on, I started to study origins of genocide and mass killing and prevention and reconciliation. And I worked at various places like Rwanda, where I had a number of projects for many years on reconciliation between groups that have harmed each other and so on. But I think these early experiences clearly shaped my work life.
A lot of the studies that you cite, including some of your own, looked at actually different behaviors of children responding to, say, cries of distress, but also adults. I wonder if you could walk us through what some of these studies tell us about people who respond to others who are distressed or in trouble versus those who do not.
Well, the first studies in this area, which were done by two psychologists, Letnay and Darley, focused on the situation and found that the larger the number of people who are present, the more likely that any one person, or the less likely that any one person will help. And I was inspired by these studies, and I studied both the circumstances that influence people's behavior, but also the personal characteristics that make it more or less likely that they will help others. And you were asking about the personal characteristics especially. And I found in a series of studies, mostly these studies of personal characteristics with adults, that the more people had a feeling of responsibility for other people's welfare, the more likely they were going to help somebody in distress. And this was true when that person was in physical distress. They would hear sounds of distress from another room. They could go into the other room, or if they didn't go into the other room, that the person from that room came in and asked for their help. And the more they had this, what I actually called, it's a big word, but pro-social value orientation, which has several elements. One of them is a positive view of human beings, concern about others' welfare, and I think the central part of it is a feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. The more they had this, the more likely they were going to help by going into the other room, or if the person came into their room, by doing something more effortful that would provide more immediate help. And the same was true also of helping somebody in psychological distress. You know, somebody, as people work together in the same room on some task, gets upset about something that she reads and then tells this other person something that upset her, that happened to her just the day before. And the more people have this orientation, concern about others, feeling of responsibility, the more likely that they engage in a helpful way. Now, so this is an important personal orientation, and I think that, you know, it includes empathy, feeling others' distress to some degree, but it has an additional element which I think is crucial beyond empathy in order for a person to take action, and that is that feeling of responsibility. And some studies we found that when that feeling of responsibility is combined with the belief that I am capable to influence others' welfare, you know, some sense of competence, belief that one can actually make a difference, then people are even more likely to help.
If an environment makes it such that people do not think they can make a difference, in particular, say, political environments where things seem overwhelming, for example, or if a society is highly individualistic, like personal responsibility rather than thinking of other responsibility, it seems like those would counteract wanting to help.
You know, that's an important point, that the immediate circumstances that people are in have an effect, but the larger social situation also has an effect. So if the larger social situation is such that it makes people feel helpless, or it makes people focus very intensely on themselves, it creates divisions between people rather than connections. You know, all of these things are going to affect people, and they are going to, in some way, modulate, change their orientation towards others, including their feeling of responsibility. So the social world as such is very important and makes a difference. You know, the last chapter in this book is creating caring societies. And in order to create caring societies, there have to be action by people on the top, ideally, action by people on the bottom, the population, all of us, and also action by people in the middle. By people in the middle, I mean people like the media that can influence both downwards and upwards, church leaders that have a potential influence downwards and upwards. All of these are, and if there is a society in which people don't care, nobody takes positive actions, if there is a tendency to cooperate, to compete primarily, rather than to cooperate with each other, when people don't join together to try to exert influence, then a person may feel helpless.
There are two things you said in this that I wanted to see if you could elaborate a little bit further. One was when you said if people focus too much on themselves, and of course we're talking also about an individualistic sort of culture, but there was also an example in your book of people who were in Nazi-controlled areas, and you interviewed these people at length, including some who had been involved in the so-called euthanasia program. It seemed, the way you described it, that they were so involved in their own lives, they didn't even notice what was going on around them.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the book is how a group of Germans that I interviewed in quite a while ago now, in 1987, I was invited by a German university to give a talk on the research that they knew I was doing, I have been doing, on altruism and helping behavior. But I asked them, could I instead talk about the origins of genocide? And I asked them if they could arrange for me a meeting with a group of Germans who were at least teenagers in the Hitler era. And they did, and I met with about 25 people like that. And we had a very good conversation, partly because I spoke enough German to communicate with them, since I lived in Vienna for a couple of years before I came to the U.S. But because my German was not that good, it kind of equaled our relationship, balanced our relationship. So rather than being the professor, which is a big thing in Germany, you know, we were kind of equal people talking to each other. And during this conversation, it was difficult for them to get away from the satisfactions of their life under Hitler when they were in youth camps and singing songs together and sitting at campfires together, and they were so involved with their own lives that they didn't look around in the world around them. Now, of course, they were also young people, and that is somewhat characteristic of young people, but not all of them were that young. And it took us a long time for them to finally say, oh, yes, I remember. And one of them said that the local Gestapo came to my father, who was renting out rooms to people, and told my father not to let rooms to Jews. But they started out saying, oh, we didn't notice. I didn't remember. You know, I didn't know what was going on. But it was so evident in Germany that it was pretty much impossible not to know what was going on. But I think that it wasn't that they were in denial. It was that they were so focused on their lives that they just didn't pay attention to the larger world.
So then people can develop a sort of tunnel vision depending on what's going on in life.
People can develop a tunnel vision so that they don't even notice. And unfortunately, they can also, depending on who they are, they can also easily shift their attention away so that they don't take in what is happening. You may remember a study that I described that we did on the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, while I was still teaching at Harvard. And I had a young Harvard student collapse on the street when some passerby was moving towards us and was about 50 yards away. And he collapsed, grabbing his knee or grabbing his heart or for some reason or another. And some people, as they were approaching on the other side of the street in this case, took a single glance and rushed over. Other people looked over, and then they were hesitating, and they were slowing down, and they were looking back, and often somebody else came by that time. But there were some people who, after a single glance, looked away, and they never looked back. And some of these people turned off the street at the next corner. And I think that people do this. They try to avoid taking in information that would make them feel that they need to take action, that they would make them feel responsible. Now, I don't think that these are the people who have this personal disposition to feel responsibility for others' welfare. But there are people who do this. And also, circumstances influence people to do this. One of the things that I talk about is how our values, even if it is high in our hierarchy of values, our caring values, our moral values, can be subverted when the environment very strongly calls on other values. So let's assume that you are a member of the president's advisory group, and there develops a strong tone about attacking another country. And there is a strong influence within the group for that. And when somebody raises any question about anything, then that person's loyalty is questioned. So under these circumstances, values, moral values, caring values, can be replaced by values of loyalty and values of responsibility to my leader and other kinds of things. And as a result, people are not guided anymore by feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. They are guided by their loyalty to the group that they are part of.
So there's a sort of canceling out of what might arise as responsibility or caring for others based on personal need to belong or be loyal or whatever that other thing is. The other part of what you mentioned, you also wrote about in the book, was about empathy. And the studies that you mentioned in your book that I find most compelling and baffling are the studies that show who tends to have empathy for whom. So, for example, very wealthy people at the very top tend to not have empathy for poor people, as an example. And this was some of the things that you wrote about, whereas poor people do tend to have empathy for all kinds of people. How do we make sense of this?
Well, there isn't really good research on trying to help to understand why this happens. But a likely reason is that people justify their wealth and position in society. People pretty much justify whatever they do, and one of the things that they justify is their wealth and their position. And they justify it by their hard work, by their intelligence, by their special qualities, and for all these reasons, they deserve the position that they are occupying. And in fact, I believe that one of the reasons that people protect their privilege is not only because they love the fruits of that privilege, the money and power, but also because they have developed a belief system according to which they have right to their privilege. Now, if that is the case, then the people who are poor, who haven't accomplished anything, they see them as not having taken responsibility for their lives, as not being diligent enough, not being intelligent enough, not being deserving enough. And I think that explains why they look down on them. And once you look down on people, and once you create a division between us and them, they are different, they are them, they are less good, they are less deserving, you feel less empathy for them. There is research that shows that the more similar we see people to ourselves, the more we feel empathy for them. So this is a real problem, really, because if you want to create a society in which people in general care for each other, a caring society, then we have to see the humanity of everybody. And this kind of looking down on people also means that we see them as less deserving and in some ways less human.
That concludes part one of our conversation with Dr. Irvin Staub, author of The Roots of Goodness. We'll continue our conversation next week. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.